Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation. It is Monday, October 20th, and it's the 20th day of the federal government shutdown. Thousands gathered this weekend to protest no kings or no dictators at rallies across the state. We'll take a closer look at our coral reefs and bring you out to Oahu's west side, where concrete blocks will be deployed to help create new artificial reefs and help minimize wave damage to our shoreline. And we look at reefs from another angle, how genetics can help us understand these fragile ecosystems. And we have a quirky story about baseball. Ever heard about banana ball? There's a Hawaii connection now. Plus, we hear more about the AI-generated actors and what that might mean for the film industry locally. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. The government shutdown enters its third week. Here in Hawaii, Governor Josh Green estimates that $120 million of economic activity is being lost each week due to the shutdown. It was against that backdrop that thousands rallied this past weekend for the No Dictators protests. We wondered if there were new issues that prompted protesters to turn out, as many had come out for previous demonstrations. The largest gathering was at the state capitol, but there were rallies held across the state.
And we gazed upon the chimes of freedom flashing.
There were many who turned out for the protests for the first time, including Clifford and Danielle Cheng.
What compelled you to come down here?
Just all the things that have been happening, and you know, it just starts to get overwhelming. And I felt it was time to do something, and thanks to my wife, we decided that this would be the place to make a stand, at least a little one.
Yeah, to actually come out for the first time. And then in trying to get our friends to come out here, you know, we were struck by how there's so much fear in just protesting, that people seem to feel that if you come out to a protest that you won't, you know, you'll be put on some list or people will target you. And if you're not, if you're a naturalized citizen, that could have repercussions for your job. Some of our friends are federal workers and they were afraid to come out. They're the ones that aren't getting paid right now during the government shutdown. But we're here to represent them because they can't, or they feel that they can't without repercussions.
Another first-time protester was University of Hawaii student Vanessa Gallegos.
Well, I come from an immigrant family, so I think I want to, what my mom did for me was she sacrificed so much of her life to give me my dreams, and then seeing her dreams and get pushed down by our government, and I feel like it's my turn to finally stick up for her.
Several visitors who came to Hawaii for vacation felt compelled to come down and join the protest, including a couple from New York. They stood with retired Army veteran David Aston, who thanked them for turning out.
Have you been out to this protest before?
No, I haven't. This is my first, but as a veteran, actually as a retiree who served 28 years, 9 months and 6 days in the Army, I felt it was my duty to come here, particularly after I heard Speaker of the House Johnson say that the protesters hate America. I don't hate America. I love America, and I love it enough to protect it from the authoritarianism that is creeping into our nation. I shouldn't say creeping in, that has actually taken hold in our nation with the Trump administration.
Is there a particular issue that has brought you out, aside from his statements about this protest?
Well, really the conduct of the actions of the Trump administration, as I said earlier, about the drift toward authoritarianism. They keep stepping over the next line and the next line, and I feel as though Congress and the Supreme Court have abrogated their responsibilities to serve as a separate but equal branch of government. If the separate branches of government aren't going to do their job, then it's incumbent upon the people to express their grievances in a peaceful manner. I'm upholding my First Amendment right.
The Conversation's D.W. Gibson also spoke to protesters at the event. Jim Danner came out to support veterans' benefits.
Tell me what brought you out here today.
Well, I'm a retired Navy chaplain, a Catholic priest, 28 years in the Navy.
And I'm very concerned about veterans' benefits. I was a senior officer, so I did pretty well. But what about the people that came in for one or two tours, which is huge to begin with, and they're losing their benefits? And so I'm out here for the veterans and their health care.
Do you hear from veterans that are in service now?
Constantly. In other words, and I get, you know, especially after this last talk that they gave at the Pentagon, I had four-star admirals calling me saying, what the heck is going on here? These guys are out of control.
Joyce Neely and James Hildebrand had been to three rallies in Hawaii. They said more and more people have turned out each time.
I noticed your sign, I'm Antifa. I wonder if you could explain that one.
Yes, I can. My dad was at Normandy, and, you know, that was a big Antifa movement, and I feel like I'm doing this for my dad and everybody else that was there, you know, so.
It's been interesting to see President Trump mention Antifa so much. I wonder if you have thoughts on how he characterizes Antifa.
You know, they mischaracterize it. It's a movement. It's not a, it's not an organization that pays dues or anything. It's a group of people who don't want to survive under fascism, you know, who don't like fascism. It hasn't been that long. I can't believe we're doing this again. I really can't, but yes, yeah.
And sir, what brought you out here today?
My wife talked me into it. No. No, this is our duty. We have to do this for our grandchildren, and we have a great-grandchild now, too, so we have to do it for him.
Yes. Amazing. Well, as you think about that great-grandchild, what are some of the issues that come foremost to your mind? I mean, there are a lot of issues on the table. What are the ones that come to mind for you?
Well, just freedom. My God, you can't even speak your mind now without being thought of as an enemy. Like, he characterizes this as a hate America session. It's anything but that, my God. This is a love America. This is a fight for America session. That's what this is all about.
Yes.
And we have to protect our children and our grandchildren.
And for the first time, the national head of Common Cause was in Honolulu. Virginia K. Solomon was on hand to see the local turnout.
Our mission is to hold power accountable. We are considered the people's lobby, so we sit in state capitals. We are at the nation's capital, advocating for everyday people, because it seems like big business, special interest, everybody has somebody representing their voice except for everyday people. And so that is our job. We hold power accountable. We advocate on behalf of things that are important to everyday people. And not on behalf of the wealthy or the business class. It's really about the average working person who is just struggling to get by and to be seen in this country. So far, we have about 7 million people just in the U.S. who have come out to protest. And that doesn't even include the numbers that we're hearing or waiting to report back from places like Ireland and the United Kingdom and all the other countries around the globe who are standing in solidarity with the U.S. today, many of whom have experienced what it's like to live under authoritarianism, and they see where we're headed and they want to help us fight back. So it's really an overwhelming sense of, I think, solidarity and also hope.
That was Virginia K. Solomon, president of Common Cause, a nonpartisan group which Solomon says was born out of the Watergate scandal. Organizers report no major issues across the state. The ACLU had hired a private security team of 9 people as a precaution and said that the Honolulu Police Department was expecting to staff the events with 60 to 100 officers, larger than any other previous demonstrations at the state capitol. Indivisible Hawaii estimates the rallies drew about 22,000 people statewide.
Support for HPR comes from Haleakala Ranch, with a legacy of livestock, conservation, and land stewardship since 1888, working to restore, maintain, and preserve the open vistas and natural beauty of Maui. More at HaleakalaRanch.com.
On the next Fresh Air, Ken Burns talks about his new PBS documentary series on the Revolutionary War. It includes the perspectives of women, Native Americans, and enslaved and free Black people, the people excluded from the Declaration, all men are created equal. We'll talk about how the war, which he says was also a civil war, echoes today. Join us.
Beginning this afternoon at 3. Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors PCAT, Pacific Center for Advanced Technology Training, and the Rice Partnership.
In the conversation, we highlighted an innovative reef and wave energy project last fall that was supposed to be in place earlier this year. But there was a setback. A dispute between the state and the military over control of submerged lands has delayed the federally funded project. Now, instead of being placed in the waters off Mokapu near the Marine Base, it will end up off Oahu's west side. We took a trip to a precast yard in Kalaeloa to see the concrete blocks for ourselves. We talked to Ben Jones, a principal University of Hawaii researcher, about where things stand.
We were going through the permitting process, and we ran into a bit of a historical issue. So it comes back to the Submerged Land Act, and even further back, actually, in 1941, early stages of World War II, the Navy set up these large naval defensive sea areas around many of the Pacific islands. And one of these areas was set up around Kaneohe Bay. And so since that time, there was also, as we said, the Submerged Land Act, I think that was 1953, and then there was the Admissions Act, of course, of Hawaii in 1959 that granted all of the public lands to the state of Hawaii, except those that were under executive orders. And in the federal government's mind, these submerged lands are federal lands, and in the state of Hawaii, they're still believed to be state lands. That disagreement really made us we needed to go and look for another site. We were dedicated to working through the state regulators on this process. We know it's important for the state of Hawaii, and we didn't want to bypass that process. And so we started looking at other sites.
Okay, so the solution now is to deploy these structures on the west side off Barbers Point Deep Draft Harbor.
That's right. We're now looking at a site that meets all of our criteria off the leeward side. It's just south of Kalaeloa Harbor. And so in June, we started community engagements here in Ewa, started with Kalaeloa Heritage Park and the Kalaeloa Heritage and Legacy Foundation to talk about the project and learn about what people are interested in, concerns. And as it turns out, there's quite a bit of excitement for most of the groups we've talked to out here. So we started with that group, received a letter of support. We met with the Kapolei Hawaiian Civic Club and Alimu Hui and talked about their interests in this. We've gotten lots of fantastic feedback. There's a lot of interest in Limu out here, which was interesting to us, and we've really looked into that a little further and understand. We don't see Limu on these beaches now, but in past times, there was more freshwater input to the coastal areas, and there was quite a bit of Limu on these beaches. So that's been added to our list of things that we would like to monitor with these systems when they go in the water. And then we met with, most recently in August, with Kapolei Neighborhood Board. Had a lot of questions, and they voted unanimously at the board to support the project, which was a surprise to us to have it done right there, but it was fantastic. And like I said, there seems to be a lot of support for the project. We've also talked to some fishers groups who have expressed some concerns. Their concerns have largely been around the large migrations of fish, like the ama-ama, so the striped mullet. They're a fish that lives principally offshore, but then they come into the sandy, shallow flats for spawning. And so these are really important migrations as a natural resource to cultural practitioners, fishers here in the community. And so they wanted to make sure those migrations weren't interrupted.
Right. So the community just wants to know exactly what you're doing and how is it going to impact traditional practices and natural resources, whether it's the seaweed or the fish.
That's exactly right. We really get the most out of these in-person discussions with these community groups because we learn about the area, we learn about the history, we can dig in and do more research on it, and we've learned since we've been discussing this with groups. But without these communications, sometimes we just don't know what the concerns are. We started engaging the community in the state, the communities in the state in 2021. So we've been through 4 years of engagements from the windward side now to the leeward side, and a lot of the changes that we've made have been directly because of those inputs.
So explain to our listeners the whole point of these structures, because the Department of Transportation is going to be the lead on this now, right? What's in it for them?
There's really these two major issues that are impacting our coastline. So we have increased storms, rising seas that are causing significant coastal erosion around our state as well as other Pacific islands. At the same time, marine heat waves are killing our coral reefs. Natural coral reefs provide an immense amount of coastal protection. They can reduce 90% of the wave energy that approaches the shore. And so these two things together are really a one-two punch to our coastlines. And so these living breakwater structures are designed, they're inspired by natural coral reefs, and they are designed to do two things, really: reduce wave energy, change the nature of the breaking waves so that they break more gently, and then provide habitat for coral and other coral reef organisms. And so it's really two things. It's protecting the coastline by reducing the wave energy and also helping restore the coral reef ecosystems.
So the State Department of Transportation, they're interested because we've got highways that are threatened. They've got the airports, the runways, that kind of thing. And since you are getting federal monies, the DOD is probably interested to see how could it affect the impact on their bases and their installations.
Yep, that's exactly right. Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency is the sponsor. They were interested in protecting DOD infrastructure, just like you said. The Hawaii Department of Transportation was early on very interested in this. There's two big factors there. They want to protect the coastlines, and they need a system that they can get community support behind. And so that's where this community engagement piece and building these and developing these with the community's input in mind is so important. And so HDOT has been a fantastic partner for us. They've been supporting us through this permitting process. They're now leading the state permitting process, and they'll be the transition partners of this prototype. They're interested in measuring the performance, seeing how it both reduces the wave energy, but also helps how the coral grows, how well the coral grows, and how it helps the adjacent ecosystem.
And what have your studies shown about the types of structures that you've designed and this company here has now manufactured? What's the success rate of making corals go faster?
Yeah, so two things. So yeah, we're here today at Jensen Infrastructure. We designed the structures, but they helped come up with how do you actually manufacture them? It's a complicated thing to cast such a irregular shape. And so they've come up with some really clever ways. They've got this beautiful lotus-shaped form. It's a large steel form that these were poured inside, and then they lift them out, and they were able to produce about one of these a day. The performance of these structures, we've tested these structures in wave flumes. We're getting up to 80% of reduction of the wave energy, which has been fantastic. And then, as you were asking, the coral growth. So we've integrated these complex shapes you see all over these. So they're shells, they're these spiral domes with all of these holes in them where we can outplant coral. But the performance on these spiral domes has been really fantastic. These were developed by the Geometric Ecology Lab, Josh Maiden's lab at HIMB, Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology. They're showing about an 80-fold increase in coral larva settlement on these structures and about a 20% increase in post-settlement survival over a control surface, just a non-structured surface. So the performance has been really fantastic, both of the large structures and the habitats.
So now we've just got to get these things in the water.
That's right. I mean, it's been an all-out push, like I said, between the permitting and the community engagement. But we continue to learn new things. We've been testing these smaller versions of these structures in Kaneohe Bay in terms of the habitat structures. And one of the other areas we've been working on is we're really interested in the biodiversity. So a lot of coral restoration has been focused on monoculture, outplanting one or maybe two different types of coral. We're looking at about 17 different species. And we look at them. There's a researcher at Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology, Claire Lewis, who has been looking at kind of the trait space. So they call it the phenotypic trait space. So think of this as what you can observe of what these coral look like when you observe them. So are they mounding? Are they plating? Are they branching? They all have different roles in the coral reef. And so we want to make sure that we cover that entire trait space with the various species so that when we do have this as a living breakwater, it's really a functional reef ecosystem. It has the different types of habitats. It has the reef building coral. It has the gluing, the coral that are encrusting, that kind of hold everything together. So it's important to have those different types of coral in the structure.
Yeah, so you want it to do what you want it to do.
We want it to do what a coral reef does naturally.
If the stars are aligned, that you could have this in the water by first quarter of next year.
That is definitely our goal, and I think that's an achievable goal at this point. And so we're working hard with the regulators and our manufacturing team, which is, they've done their job. And so, yeah, we're ready to go. We just need to continue to be responsive with the regulators and the community. So the 20 that you see here are the structure, that what we call the back reef structures. And then there are 40 larger structures, each about the size of a shipping container, that are at our other partner, so GPRM Precast. So they are another concrete precast company. And so in total, 60 of these large breakwater structures and about 1,000 of these smaller habitat modules that we've integrated. We'll get them to Kalaeloa Harbor and Mackay Ocean Engineering, which is our ocean engineering partner on this, our commercial industry partner. They've designed this catamaran system. They call it the SeaCat, and they will literally float these systems out underneath a frame that is floated on pontoons, and they will lower them into the water. We're in about 12 to 15 feet of water, so it's fairly shallow. The goal for these, and if you think of a natural coral reef, when the waves are breaking, sometimes you'll see the reef peak up above the waves. That's the depth. That's why these are as tall as they are. These are about 5 feet, and the other ones are about 7 feet tall, and they'll be in about 10 to 12 feet of water. And when you have heavy surf coming through, you might just see the tips of these like you would on a natural reef.
That was Ben Jones at the University of Hawaii. You know, we asked if the blocks may pose a hazard to mariners. Jones says they will not be in an area where mariners traverse, but they will likely mark the area to alert small boaters or fishermen. To date, the project has been awarded $22 million, but an additional $3 million of federal funds to monitor progress has been cut. So Jones says he is looking for funds elsewhere. He hopes to get final permits from the Department of Land and Natural Resources by the end of the year and to get those blocks in the water next spring. We continue looking at our coral reefs this morning, and joining us is HPR's Catherine Kluwit-Pachtel. Good morning.
Good morning.
So you've been looking at, what, coral genetics? What's this about a mother reef?
Yeah, so Kaiku Kahuluwa is someone born on Molokai. He went to high school on Oahu, and now he is a Stanford University doctoral candidate, and he's working on his PhD dissertation on coral genetics in Maui Nui. And, you know, as we're familiar with around the world, coral bleaching is a phenomenon that happens when coral gets stressed, it turns white. And this often happens when it's exposed to rising water temperatures. So as we see climate change creating those higher temperatures in the water, It's a sign that the coral isn't healthy, it's not thriving, and that heat is affecting its health, essentially. And so Kaiku's research has a few different goals. He is looking to find which corals are showing resilience to these heat conditions and where they're located. He's also looking at finding locations where coral spawns widely and it spreads to neighboring areas or to other islands. We'll talk a little bit about that in a minute. But as you mentioned, those reefs that are highly connected to other reefs are known as mother reefs. And so Kaiku talked about how his research is working to identify locations that have both resilient coral and those that produce widely spreading spawn. And so he's looking at targeting those areas for community designations or protections.
So we know that marine protected areas can help us preserve our natural resources, but we shouldn't just put marine protected areas anywhere and instead target critical locations that can optimize conservation efficiency. We want to protect the least amount of area that can provide the maximum amount of output. In terms of coral reefs, these critical reef areas can have two characteristics. The first is thermally tolerant reefs, and the second is reefs with high genetic connectivity, or mother reefs. Starting with thermally tolerant reefs, this is just basically the idea that some corals are more resistant to climate change than others. We call the corals that can handle a lot of heat thermally tolerant, and we call the corals that can't handle that much heat thermally sensitive. And the thermally sensitive ones are the ones that are going to bleach more and likely disappear as we progress throughout climate change. Another important thing about bleaching tolerance and genetics is that Thermal tolerance can be passed to offspring, and this is huge. This is really important because if parent corals are thermally tolerant, then their children can be thermally tolerant as well.
Yeah, it's that resilience, right? And, you know, I hadn't heard too much about this mother reef concept, but it's just fascinating.
It is. So based on the research of previous research of scientists who tracked where these coral spawn are winding up, Kaiku is looking particularly at Oluwalu, which is a area in West Maui known for its reef. And coral spawning is in corals breed by basically releasing sperm and eggs at the same time with the lunar cycle, and they travel with the current. So these larvae, as they call them, can stay alive in the water up to 40 days, and they travel with the currents, and where they end up is one of the things that Kaiku is looking to confirm with his research. And so if you look at these maps that were created, again, by previous researchers, it shows from Oluwalu these currents carrying coral spawn across the entire western coast of Maui, as well as across the channel to Molokai. And so that's one of the areas that Kaiku is looking at, particularly with his research, is the Kawelo Reef Track. It's an area on the south shore of Molokai that is extremely rich in its reef resources. And so based on this research, he thinks that Oluwalu could be a mother reef. And so the genetic testing that is sort of the next step of his research will prove whether or not that's true, whether coral in Oluwalu, which has been shown already to be thermally resistant or resilient to the rising water temperatures, could be the same genetic material that is traveling to Molokai. And so another of his research goals is to identify which genes specifically in these coral are making them, some corals, resilient to heat or heat tolerant. And so he took about 1,000 samples from 25 sites on Maui and Molokai, and he is putting them in heat in controlled tanks. So there's a control section and then a heating section of the tanks, and he's incrementally raising the temperature over a period of 6 days, basically to see which coral is bleaching faster than others. And so, again, you know, the next step is to really test the genetics of this coral. But Kaiku shares how he hopes his research will impact his community and how it ties together science and Hawaiian culture.
When I think of South Shore Molokai, I think of my family. I think of the people that rely on those areas, those mud flats, those reefs. But I never actually thought about where those corals come from. And I didn't know that corals come from different areas. I thought they would stay in the same areas. But corals spawn in the summer. And during the summer, you have strong south swells. And the currents by the South Shore of Molokai, they pull and they rip really fast. And so it makes a lot of sense for corals, when they release their babies, for them to be moving around. And that's something that's just not really general knowledge to the public. But with this designation, with this identification of the mother keiki reef relationship, the Oluwalu Kawela reef track relationship, that can become common knowledge for a lot of Hawaiians across the state and help them understand that these different communities are actually very much connected through their coral reefs. And I think that's going to be the biggest output my research. It's not that I feel like if we do indeed find that these reefs are greatly connected, which I believe we will, the whole marine protected area thing is great because we need to protect our natural resources. But for me personally, being able to connect these separate communities that are on different islands, being able to really tie them together with their coral reefs, satisfies me a lot on a cultural level.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. But thank you so much, Catherine, for highlighting this.
Thank you. We look forward to learning more about his research.
Absolutely. That was HPR's Catherine Kluwa-Pachtel. Look for her stories on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Ferraro Choi, Hawaii Architects designing scientific support facilities for the National Science Foundation across Antarctica. FerraroChoi.com.
There is a sense that, you know, this administration says and does a lot of stuff that doesn't actually happen, that changes the next day. And so I think investors have really started to try not to react to those more superfluous things and instead focus on what's real.
I'm Natalie Kitroev. That's Today on the Daily from the New York Times.
Beginning this evening at 6:30.
Support for HPR comes from Hawaii Energy, providing local businesses customized energy plans. Learn more about lighting upgrades available through February at hawaiienergy.com/lighting.
It's baseball like you've never seen before. That's the promise of the Savannah Bananas in their unique spin on the game. They call it Banana Ball. The new twist on America's favorite pastime has sold out as the show has been sweeping the country. Two new Banana Ball teams were unveiled this month. Take a listen to Savannah Bananas owner Jesse Cole announcing the Loco Beach Coconuts and their associated dance troupe.
You're new!
We are the Loco Beach Hooligans!
Yep, you heard that right. They're calling themselves the Hooligans, and front and center is a professional wrestler who is known in the ring as the Hawaiian Warrior. Keikoa Wong's parents met in Hawaii, but he was raised in a small town in Pennsylvania. Wong spoke with The Conversation's Maddie Bender about his training in professional wrestling led him to the world of Banana Ball and the line between cultural appreciation and appropriation.
What was it like growing up as a Hawaiian? Did you feel like your classmates knew very much about you or your culture?
Unfortunately, grew up with a lot of Howleys. I was very much, you know, a standout as far as, like, you know, of course, like, I looked completely different than everybody else. And when I was younger, because, you know, I'm Hawaiian and I'm Chinese, the Chinese side of me kind of stood out a little bit more when I was younger. I was made fun of, like, my entire growing up, being as a young kid in a predominantly white neighborhood. So it wasn't as accepting now. A lot more people are trying to teach each other, like, and teach their kids, like, how to be more accepting. Like, we love all of these different cultures. I kept to myself in the aspect of anything that made me seem different. So even wrestling, like, I really tried not to talk about wrestling even to, like, other kids unless they were, like, my close friends, because then people thought wrestling was weird. It was like, oh, you like that? Like, you're a nerd. You know what I mean? It wasn't until I got a little bit older that, you know, I had a little bit bigger of a circle. So then I started, you know, being a little bit more of myself, if that makes sense. And then once wrestling came around, well, we have to be some type of gimmick. We have to be some type of, you know, larger than life image. So then it was really like accepting of, like, well, this is really who I am. Like, I have to run with this because my name is Keikoa. Like, it's not a gimmick. A lot of people assume that it's just like a stage name or a ring name. And I'm like, no, this is who I am. This is who I've always been. So I've definitely been a lot more myself for a long time now. But yeah, when I was a kid, absolutely not.
Talk a bit more about wrestling and your persona. We've had a few wrestlers on the show, and every time I'm so struck by the mix of athletics and almost entertainment or artistry that it is.
Yeah, it's a lot. A lot of people don't realize how much it's improv, how much it's reactionary to what is going on, how much you have to remember so many different things that are going on. And I could talk about that all day. But as far as my stage name, my persona, originally I was just called Keikoa the Flying Hawaiian because that's what they called me when I played basketball, because I used to be able to dunk. I used to be able to jump pretty high. And my teammates would say, like, I was almost kind of like floating in the air. So that's how I got the nickname. And I didn't know what else to call myself, really. And then around like 9 years into my career at this point, I was starting to work with bigger companies, but they were like, we need a little bit more of your culture. And I was kind of generic because I would wear a Hawaiian shirt. I would throw lays out to the, you know, fans and stuff like that. And they were right. There wasn't as much history in myself. And maybe that was part of like, well, I've always held myself back. So I've never dove into the history of Hawaii or just Hawaiian warriors in general, whatever the case is. So then I started researching and then I based a character off of King Kamehameha. But as I was learning about Kamehameha, I had read a bunch of stories where I'm like, he's kind of a heel. Like he's done some bad things, but we look at the good of like what he did as far as like uniting the islands and everything like that. But I'm like, he's done some bad stuff. So I'm like, I could twist that and I can be like this evil king. And what if I call myself the warrior king? I was like, all right, so that makes sense. So then I adapted like his helmet, but then I modernized it a little bit. I got his robe and I made it mine. I made a big spear. I tried emulating that. But then the problem was people were so used to me being a good guy for so long that, and now I was a bad guy. And they were like, but your gear looks so like, you look like a Mortal Kombat character. Like you look awesome. Like, I don't want to boo you. Like, I don't want to hate you. And I was like, well, that's not working. Cause if I'm going to be a bad guy, like I need you to hate everything about me. You can't think I'm cool. So then I was like, well, I just bought all of this stuff. It's all this custom made stuff. So what am I going to do with it? And then it like, literally it was right in front of me the whole time. I knew that Kikoa means courageous warrior. I knew it was a warrior name my entire life. And I was like, why don't I just call myself the Hawaiian warrior? It's literally right there. And I just steered into it and I kept pretty much everything. Like I kept the robe, I kept the helmet. I got rid of the spear because I don't need a weapon, but that's how like it's evolved. And that's why I still call myself the Hawaiian warrior to this day. And I've just tried changing different things and not necessarily being a lot more of like what a true Hawaiian warrior traditionally would wear, but just looking for like, what would somebody look at what I'm wearing and go like, oh, that makes sense to me.
When did Banana Ball get on your radar?
What was funny was the wrestling school that I work for, it's called House of Champions. I'm the head coach. One of the owners, his name is Nick. He's actually one of the firefighters for Banana Ball. And the professor, the guy that is the announcer for Banana Ball, he used to be a pro wrestling ring announcer. So, and he's like the casting director. So he knows that wrestlers can easily translate and transition into what Banana Ball is doing. So he had gone to Nick and he's like, hey, do you know any like Polynesians? And he was like, yeah, he's like, you know, Keiko, like my head coach, like he would be pretty much the only Polynesian I know. He might know one or two more, but of course, like my name came up first. The professor was like, well, you know, yeah, I know Keikoa, but like we're looking for a little bit more like heavier set Polynesians. We're looking for like hula dancers. But then as he was researching it, he was like, well, hula dancers tend to not be heavier set. They usually are like pretty much in shape. So then it kind of changed the conversation or maybe just opened up to like what he was looking for. So then it came back to me and then I got a random text message from him and he's like, hey, I'm sure Nick told you, but like we're casting. And I was like, no, he didn't tell me. Cause it was kind of like blown off of like, well, no, we're not really interested. That's not what we're looking for. So Nick didn't even mention it to me. So it was a surprise to me. But yeah, I did an interview with him and a bunch of the other cast members. They asked me to make an audition tape. So I came to the school one day and I just put the lays on. I put the grass skirt on and I just went all out. It was super hokey. Showed them I can do a bunch of flips and twists and all that stuff. And just showed like, hey, I got some energy. And they loved my video, thankfully. And, you know, a couple weeks later, I was on stage doing the same thing. So, yeah, pretty easy transition for me.
Give our listeners a sense of who the hooligans are, but also in the context of this new team that was just announced to play Banana Ball.
The Loco Beach Coconuts.
The Loco Beach Coconuts, yeah.
So a lot of the other teams have like a home city, a home state. We have the Texas Tailgaters. We have the Savannah Bananas from Savannah, Georgia. So Loco Beach, there is no Loco Beach. Their thought was Loco Beach is more of like a mindset. Like we can bring the beach, we can bring the vibes and the party to anybody. That's how that started. And then of course, like if you're going to have the beach, you're going to have good vibes. Like, and you need people that are going to dance. Cause like literally we dance from inning one to even the rope drop. Like we have a rope drop ceremony where like all the fans come in and we have like a little bit of a, almost like a tailgating party before they even come into the stadium. So we're dancing there. We're dancing during the game. And then we have a post show party. Like we dance there too. So like, it's just the vibes need to be up at all times. So I think the Coconuts fit Banana Ball so well. And especially just the different dynamics of myself, Aaron Nova, Falaba, and Demetrius, that we were all casted for this. Like, we're all completely different people. and we just have our own little flavor to bring to the hooligans. And the internet has been very welcoming to us already. Like, we just posted a couple quick videos and people are like, this is my new favorite team. And I'm like, we didn't even do anything yet. We're just shaking our hips for a TikTok video. Like, but okay. Like, if you're on board, like, hey, like, I'm on board.
Are you hoping to bring some accuracy to the hula performance? Or, I mean, it's interesting also to hear your own backstory, how you went from something like a little more, maybe the popular image of like what Hawaiian or what Polynesian culture was like to something a little more true to your identity. What do you think about all of that?
So I definitely pitched different ideas of like what we would wear, because like for anybody that's listening that didn't see the schedule announcement or the championship game, like we were shirtless all weekend, but we were supposed to wear these blue Hawaiian shirts that matched the jerseys. They just didn't come in time. I think they got stuck in customs or something like that. So after we were shirtless, I kind of went to Professor, the casting director, and was like, do you feel like that's more of the vibe where like we're just shirtless and then maybe we wear more of like a cloth skirt, something that is a little bit more modern and not as hokey, you know? Do we do that? Or if we wear the shirts, because for those that haven't seen, Fala Ba, he's a big dude. There's no way that he's going to be able to button up that Hawaiian shirt if that's still what they want us to wear. So I'm like, okay, so then his shirt's going to be open. I'm an in-shape guy, so I'm like, I'd probably like cut my sleeves to make it mine, you know what I mean? And maybe have it a little bit unbuttoned or something like that. Like whatever we can kind of like do to make it our own. So I pitched that and he was like, well, maybe we wear the shirts during the rope drop ceremony. And then maybe during the game, you guys take them off. And then maybe that's a moment. Maybe we wear this for a home game, this for an away game. He's like, the options are endless. We're just getting started. So I'm excited to see what their vision is. But I definitely would love to bring a little bit more authenticity into the group because I know how passionate people are, especially with, you know, our culture, you know. But the other thing is sometimes like it catches people's eyes a little bit more when it is a little bit on the hokier side, which is like for me, like the only reason I wear this necklace is because people look at the necklace, they look at my long hair, they see my tribal tattoos and they're like, oh, that guy must be Hawaiian. You know, there's times where like if this is covered up and like I have my facial hair growing in, like people assume I'm Spanish. There's some times where we just have to kind of do certain things to get people to recognize it. And that's the theater aspect of it as well. But no, I definitely agree. I definitely want to bring some more authenticity to it as much as we can and whatever else that we can do to just bring people together for this.
It really seems like it is collaborative. And because it's a new team and a new troupe, you're going to work it out.
Yeah, it's only been 3 days. We got a whole season next year. We got a couple months to get ready for it. So, yeah, we got time.
And one more moment from the announcement ceremony is that the OG Flying Hawaiian, Shane Victorino, was there. And he was announced to be kind of a primetime coach, right, for special games for the Loco Beach Coconuts. So what was that like, seeing him there?
So it's funny because, you know, when I was the Flying Hawaiian, like he was playing, you know, so everyone was always like, oh, I thought Shane Victorino was the Flying Hawaiian. And I'm like, yeah, I know. That's what they call him too. But now, like when I hear the name, like I think of, you know, myself at that young age, it almost gives me like cringe vibes of what I used to do back then, because I'm like, man, I just like was not guided well within my industry. I didn't have someone to lean on to kind of go like, hey, you're a little hokey, you're a little generic, like stop doing this, stop doing that. Like I was trying to figure out everything on my own. I did make sure I got a picture with him. And then I even think I put in the caption, like, it's completely his. That's his name. That's it. Like, I don't want to be called that anymore. But yeah, it was definitely like a full circle moment for me of just like standing there. And I'm like, how did I get here? Like, here's the guy that I always used to battle with every single time of like, that's my name, that I get that it's his name. But then like, here I am taking a picture with him. I was like, it's just, life is weird. I always have these full circle moments. And then I almost kind of stand there. I'm like, how did I get here? I was doing that during the grand finale of the schedule announcement. The fireworks are going off. The fans are going crazy. I'm like, how did I get here? Life's been very good to me. I'm very blessed. I'm very appreciative of just how my journey has gone.
Thank you so much, Kakoa Wong. This was so fun to talk to you.
Thank you so much.
That was Kakoa Wong, hooligan dancer for the Loco Beach Coconuts. He spoke with HBR's Maddie Bender. Banana Ball will be coming to 45 states this upcoming baseball season, but not Hawaii. Wong says he hopes to one day bring the Loco Beach Coconuts to the islands.
Support for HPR comes from Kona Stories Bookstore on Hawaii Island, offering new releases, classics, educational toys and books for children, and gifts. Open 7 days a week. Online ordering available at konastories.com.
On this week's On the Media, people are using apps like Eyes Up and Red Dot to document ICE activities.
Arrested for hindering a federal investigation.
I'm not even.
Meanwhile, the government is playing whack-a-mole to take them down.
Apple complied, and that sets off this domino effect where Google then removes Red Dot.
On this week's On the Media from WNYC.
Beginning this evening at 7, following The Daily.
Support for HPR comes from HMSA. For over 87 years, providing health plans to the people of Hawaii with a commitment to supporting the health and well-being of the community. Learn more at hmsa.com.
And finally this hour, we turn our attention to artificial intelligence in the entertainment field. Here with more on the developments is HPR's Cassie Ordonio. Good morning.
Good morning, Catherine. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so what's this about Tilly?
So Hollywood and Hawaii's film industry has made it clear that they're not rolling out the red carpets for Tilly Norwood, which is an AI actress created by London-based company Particle 6. And that's been causing quite a stir with the union, SAG-AFTRA, and IATSE Local 665, and some of the actors who fear that this AI actress could be taking their jobs. And I spoke into Native Hawaiian actress Krista Alvarez, who's been acting for 15 years, who actually is worried about her job and the representation of Native Hawaiian culture.
Of course, as an actress, we always fear getting the role. Like, that's our top thing is like, and we're always looking inward at like, are we good enough? Are we? And so with this, with the AI, with Tilly Norwood and AI entering the realm of possibly taking over and replacing us as actors, that's a very scary thing. Also, I think from a cultural perspective, who is going to be, you know, if they come up with a character who's supposed to be a Hawaiian? Well, now we have that in the hands of whoever's creating this character, and are the cultural elements of this character going to be honored, and is it going to be authentic? You know, I think so. Authenticity is, I think it's a major issue. And then also on the audience stand, and how specifically like women and young women, how is the portrayal of this AI character going to impact our younger generation of women and with their self-identity? Now they're comparing themselves to, which once was other women, now it's a completely made up identity. And so that is very, very scary for me.
Really makes you think.
Yeah, and you could hear it in Krista's voice that she struggled on whether to call Tilly Norwood a she or an it. However, the film industry has been bracing itself for the use of AI, but the creation of a replication of a human figure kind of crosses the line, which is what some of the actors have told me. However, but there's also some people in the film industry who have benefited from using artificial intelligence. Folks like Elliot Lucas from the Kauai Film Academy, who created the local movie Too Much Life, and he's been using AI to map out his financial plan, but condemns the replication of real life people.
For me, AI is making our job a lot easier, or I should say cheaper and quicker in a lot of ways. Visual effects are easier. Cleaning audio is easier. Just general audio effects are easier. Things that took us months to do in post-production for Too Much Life, all of a sudden now, a year later, would have taken us 5 seconds. So huge savings in money, and it allows us to make movies that look like $10 million movies for $1 million. You know, AI is kind of coming, my philosophical understanding of AI, and I could be totally wrong, this is just my opinion, but you know, AI is coming whether everybody wants it or not, right? And so how do you adapt to work in that sphere?
Yeah, it's already here.
It's kind of similar to when Wikipedia was first created or the calculator. You kind of have to adapt to it. However, you know, advocates are pushing for state and federal lawmakers to have some type of regulations on artificial intelligence. On the federal level, there actually is no such universal regulation, but various states have adopted their own policies. California was actually the first state in the country to adopt a policy on regulating artificial intelligence, particularly AI companies. Hawaii, we have a law, but it only bans political deepfakes. It doesn't outright ban it. And so a lot of these film industry advocates and the unions are urging them to have more of a universal law, taking that up to the federal level, because if you have too much inconsistencies in different states, that could cause loopholes for AI companies to kind of bounce from state to state. I've also spoken to Congressman Ed Case, who said there are talks in Congress about AI regulation, but there's not been yet a drafted legislation as of yet.
I strongly believe that we need a comprehensive federal law or set of laws to direct the growth of AI and to appropriately regulate its abuses. That has not developed yet in our country at the federal level. And as a result, we are dealing with really a number of states who are moving much faster than the federal government, California being really the leading state on this, to develop their own set of laws, rules, and regulations governing AI. Everything from the protection of creative product to the real downsides of AI, such as, you know, the manipulation of online content who really commit what amounts of crimes against people. Europe has developed its own broader set of rules and regulations dealing with AI, so they're probably the leader in the world. Some take issue with Europe's approach. In this country, what I believe we should do is come up with uniform federal laws and standards that apply to all parts of the country, because at the end of the day, we do not want really a patchwork of inconsistent laws and regulations across the country where there's perhaps too much regulation in some places, too little regulation in some places.
Yeah, you do get a patchwork.
And the Actors Union SAG-AFTRA, in its contract, studios may not use synthetic performers without giving notice and bargaining over terms. But however, the law doesn't cover AI companies can't scrape performances, actually. So SAG-AFTRA is actually alleging that Tilly Norwood has stolen performances from real-life actors and actresses, and something that some AI companies do, or the creation of AI, they do kind of take bits and pieces from the internet that's already available. We're kind of seeing that already with the R&B singer with the last name Monet, who its creator signed like a multi-million dollar deal. So that's been really concerning to a lot of folks in the film industry. And Eileen van der Velden, who is Tilly Norwood's creator, wrote in Norwood's Instagram that Norwood's not a replacement for human being, but a creative work.
Yeah, a little bit Frankensteinish, right? Yeah. All right. Well, thank you so much, Cassie.
Thanks for having me.
We've been talking to HPR's culture and arts reporter, Cassie Ordonio, who's been looking into AI in the film industry. We are all out of time, so that's it for us today. Tomorrow, we plan to hear about Kahuli, our native snails. Got feedback for us? Call our talkback line, 808-792-8217. Did you know you can find the conversation as a podcast? Head to our website or search for it on Spotify or Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. We'll be back tomorrow with more of the conversation.